brinksmanship over the nation's statutory debt limit, raising fears that the fragile U.S. economy could be rattled by a calamitous self-inflicted wound. For years, Republicans have sought to tie spending cuts or other concessions from Democrats to their votes to lift the borrowing cap, even if it means eroding the world's faith that the United States will always pay its bills. Now back in control of a chamber of Congress, Republicans are poised once again to leverage the debt limit to make fiscal demands of President Biden. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned recently that she would have to undertake extraordinary measures to continue paying the nation's bills beyond January if lawmakers did not act to raise the debt limit, and that her powers to delay a default could be exhausted by early June. The fight over the debt limit is renewing debates about what the actual consequences would be if the U.S. were unable to borrow money to pay its bills, including what it owes to the bondholders who own U.S. Treasury debt and essentially provide a line of credit to the government. Some Republicans argue that the ramifications of breaching the debt limit and defaulting are overblown. Democrats and the White House, along with a variety of economists and forecasters, warn of dire scenarios that include the shutdown of basic government functions, a hobbled public health system, and a deep and painful financial crisis. Also, RT had an eye on this issue, writing, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned of dire consequences the country may be facing if it doesn't hike its statutory debt ceiling in the coming month. According to the senior official, the U.S. could default on its debt by summer, which would lead to a financial crisis. It makes me nervous. It would be devastating. It's a catastrophe, Yellen told Axios News outlet, adding that we will have a financial crisis and I believe we would have recession in the United States. Spending would have to decline to match the tax revenues, Yellen said, which would strip the government of the ability to support the economy with the stimulus. Furthermore, psychological consequences like people fearing to spend money could then further impact the spending and deepen a recession. She noted that a full-blown U.S. debt default would also send ripple effects across the global economy. Yellen said Americans would face higher borrowing costs, and it would cause a good deal of turmoil globally as well. The secretary began to raise the alarm on potential U.S. debt default earlier this month, notifying the U.S. Congress that the Treasury had started to invoke emergency measures to prevent the country from reaching the national debt ceiling, now set at $31.4 trillion. The measures largely involve temporarily suspending payments that are not immediately necessary to keep the government running. Yellen noted at the time, however, that the measures only go as far as to give the Congress time to negotiate and pass a debt limit hike, most likely until early June. She said, without the hike, default would be imminent. The president and the leadership of Congress are responsible to find a way to get the debt ceiling raised, she told Axios. The debt ceiling, which was first enacted by the Congress in 1917, prevents the U.S. Treasury from issuing new government bonds to fund government operations after the debt ceiling is reached. Exceeding that limit means that the federal government's ability to make routine budget payments, including paying for various social expenditures, is at risk. Moreover, the government's ability to pay debts and interest on obligations already incurred could be seriously undermined.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The U.S. announced on January 25th that it will send 31 M1 Abrams tanks to Ukraine. The tanks may take months or even years to arrive and may never see the battlefield. The M1 Abrams is the main battle tank of the U.S. military and is one of the most powerful and sophisticated tanks in the world. But for Ukraine, that is both the advantage and the problem. In his comments announcing the decision, U.S. President Joe Biden said that delivering the tanks to Ukraine will take time without further specification.
Today, I'm announcing that the United States will be sending 31 Abrams tanks to Ukraine, the equivalent of one Ukrainian battalion. Secretary Austin has recommended this step because it will enhance the Ukraine's capacity to defend its territory and achieve its strategic objectives. The Abrams tanks are the most capable tanks in the world. They're also extremely complex to operate and maintain. So we're also giving Ukraine the parts and equipment necessary to effectively sustain these tanks on the battlefield.
Military analysts say it could take a year or more for all these Abrams to make it to Ukraine. So any expectations that these tanks will have an immediate impact on the fighting needs to be tempered. The tanks will be purchased from General Dynamics, the manufacturer of the tank. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said it will take many months for General Dynamics to build them. Kirby said the U.S. doesn't have the extra tanks in its arsenal, and even if there were excess tanks, it would still take many months, suggesting that the unbuilt tanks will take even longer to arrive. While the estimated timeline suggests that the tanks cannot have an immediate impact on the conflict, it seems that may never have been the intention. The decision may have been more strategic and diplomatic than military. The Biden administration made the decision against the advice of the Pentagon. The tank the U.S. really wants on the battlefields of Ukraine is the German Leopard 2. But Germany was never going to send them without the cover of the U.S. agreeing to send their tanks. In case there was any doubt, on January 19th, at the World Economic Forum, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz privately but very directly told the U.S. delegation that Germany was not going to send their tanks until the U.S. agreed to send theirs. The U.S. may never have intended the Abrams tanks for the current war. They may not even be the right tanks for this war. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Mark Milley had both recommended against sending M1 Abrams tanks to Ukraine. In addition to how long it takes to train personnel to operate the tanks and how difficult the tanks are to maintain, they have also said that the Abrams tanks are not the right vehicles for the fight in Ukraine right now. By promising to send the tanks without ever specifying a delivery date, the U.S. may have succeeded in giving Germany and Europe cover to send their Leopard tanks without ever actually sending U.S. tanks onto the current battlefield. Most NATO members in Europe have kept open the possibility of sending their F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine, even as U.S. President Joe Biden said Washington would not do so. Air defense experts say U.S.-built F-16 fighter jets would offer Ukraine an edge over the Russian Air Force, but only if combined with powerful missiles and targeting information which the West would also have to provide, drawing it more actively into the war. There are clear advantages to the F-16. It is the world's most produced fighter jet, with many being decommissioned in Europe as NATO members transition to the F-35. Lockheed Martin, which produces the F-16, told the Financial Times it can increase production to replace planes sent to Ukraine. But there are practical and symbolic concerns. Experts say training Ukrainian pilots on F-16s might not be carried out in time to make a difference in the war this year. Also, bringing in Western pilots, even as privateers, could create political complications. Ukraine has reportedly prepared a batch of 50 pilots who have flown in Western military exercises and could be trained in 3 months. The symbolic concern is over losses of aircraft. Russia's development of hypersonic missiles could prove a match for the F-16, ending the narrative of NATO superiority. Perhaps for such reasons, there are still naysayers in the Western alliance. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, after bowing to pressure to send Leopard 2 battle tanks to Ukraine, said he would not be sending the jets. The West, the U.S. in particular, has supplied Ukraine with arms and munitions worth billions of dollars since the beginning of the war in February last year. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has recently doubled down on the need for new weapons from his Western backers to counter Russia's military advances, urging the West to send long-range missiles and fighter jets in addition to tanks.
We have to open the supply of long-range missiles to Ukraine, and it is important that we expand our cooperation in artillery, and we have to start supplying aircraft to Ukraine. This is our dream and our task.
Russia has frequently warned that Western weapons supply to Ukraine will only prolong the war.
While the British public is grappling with an unprecedented cost of living crisis, the dismissal of a high-ranking Tory official has added insult to the injury of millions of Britons. That after it emerged that chairman of the Conservative Party, Nadeem Zahawi, paid a penalty to HM Revenue and Customs over previously unpaid tax as part of a multi-million pound dispute while he was Chancellor. HM Revenue and Customs is a non-ministerial department of the UK government responsible for collecting taxes. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak was quick to react to save his party from yet another scandal. He fired Zahawi for what he called serious breaches of the ministerial code over his tax affairs. An investigation by Sunak's ethics advisor concluded that Zahawi had broken the rules by repeatedly failing to declare an HMRC probe into his tax affairs. The dispute concluded with a £5 million settlement, including a penalty. But on Sunday, Sunak sent a letter to Zahawi saying his ethic advisor had concluded there was, quote, a serious breach of the ministerial code. In the letter, Sunak also announced his removal from the post. The dismissal came as Sunak was under fire himself for initially standing by Zahawi before ordering an internal investigation. But the Premier defended his stance, arguing that integrity in politics was the reason he did not sack the Tory chairman in time.
I think that's the right thing to do, to ensure that we have integrity in politics, but to do that in a professional way, that's what we're doing.
But many Britons remain unsatisfied with Sunak's handling of the issue. They reason out that the Prime Minister, who acted within hours over his advisor's report, should have sacked Zahawi earlier.
Well, Nadeem Zahawi obviously should be thinking about his future, but I think the bigger question here is why the Prime Minister didn't act earlier, what he knew about this situation, and why he seems to be continuously putting the interests of his party above those of his country. He knew there were allegations about Zahawi for a long time. He then knew that Zahawi had been negotiating a deal with HMRC at the same time as he was in charge of HMRC as the Chancellor. So I think the biggest question today isn't actually for Zahawi, it's actually for the Prime Minister.
Sunak also faces scrutiny over whether he knew about the minister's tax affairs and when he was told there could be a reputational risk to the government after Zahawi's appointment in October. Now many, including former high-ranking officials, suggest that Sunak's premiership risks being brought down by scandals swirling around the Tories. One such is high-stakes parliamentary inquiry into whether Sunak's predecessor Boris Johnson misled lawmakers over Partygate. The sacking of Nadeem Zahawi comes as Sunak's government, facing decades-high inflation and a wave of public sector strike, while trailing badly in opinion polls ahead of an expected 2024 election. To many, the tax evasion of Zahawi has not come as a surprise. But for a prime minister who promised accountability, professionalism and integrity while taking office, this is just a disgrace. But what happens when governments, especially in so-called first world countries, are submerged in corruption? Many argue that politics in those countries are too chaotic to the point where things get out of hand, like what happened in the case of Zahawi. So the ironic situation is when a man briefly in charge of the treasury does not pay taxes himself while insisting that others must pay. Apart from that, the UK is already grappling with a cost of living crisis which has been unprecedented in a century. This, coupled with the skyrocketing inflation, have so far prompted hundreds of thousands of workers from various sectors, including railway, postal, dock, energy and medical, to stage walkouts over pay and working conditions. While workers' union accuse the government of inaction and call for talks to resolve the disputes, workers want their pay in line with the inflation that is currently at the level of nearly 11%. The UK is also facing rampant food and energy costs. Some even struggle to make ends meet or even afford to put food on the table.
There's people around here who can't afford to put clothes on their kids' backs or food on their table, and that he has mistakenly missed an error.
Charities are stocking up duvets, sleeping bags, hot water bottles, and blankets because they know that people can't afford to heat their homes anymore. That puts in the spotlight the number of governments which one after another took the helm at number 10 and attempted to resolve the cost of living crisis, but to no avail. The much bigger question is that how can the Sunak government run the country when it is unable to cope with this and other crises happening over there? The situation in Israeli-occupied East Al-Quds remains volatile after a number of shooting operations there took the lives of at least 9 people and wounded several others. In the latest incident, 2 Israelis were wounded in an operation in the Silwan neighborhood of Al-Quds on Saturday morning. The Israeli Emergency Medical Services said one of those injured was in critical condition. The shooter, identified as a 13-year-old Palestinian, was wounded. The incident was the second Palestinian operation in Al-Quds in less than a day. On Friday, at least 7 people were killed and several others wounded in a shooting operation outside a synagogue in the Israeli-occupied East Al-Quds. Resistance movements hailed the operation. The Al-Quds Brigades, which is the military wing of the Islamic Jihad movement, praised the attack as a courageous operation. They said the attack was a natural response to the Israeli occupation and the regime's crimes against Palestinians. The Al-Quds Brigades said the operation is a testament to unity among resistance groups. Hamas also lauded the operation. The movement said the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will pay the price for any new mistake that Tel Aviv could make. Lebanon's Hezbollah and Yemen's Ansar Allah movement also separately praised the action. The Friday incident followed a Thursday Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank, where at least 10 Palestinians were killed in cold blood by Israeli troops. Thursday marked the deadliest day for the Palestinians since the start of the new year. Israeli troops barred medical teams from reaching the area. Regime forces also stormed a hospital in Jenin and intentionally fired tear gas towards its pediatrics department. Separately, Israeli forces demolished a sports club in the refugee camp. All what is going on in the occupied territories is happening in the silence of the international community. The mainstream media closed its eyes to the deadliest Israeli raid on the Palestinian community in the occupied land this year, and instead, they took the side of the Israelis in the recent tensions. From the United States to Germany, to France and Ukraine, almost everyone expressed concern about the lives of Israelis during the recent violence. We'll be right back. The storming of the Jenin refugee camp is indicative of the regime's aggressive nature in dealing with Palestinians, especially since the emergence of extremist ideologies in the Israeli cabinet. Many argue that the current Israeli cabinet is the most extremist ever since its installation in the occupied land. What highlights this extremism is the recent storming of the Al-Aqsa Mosque by Israeli far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir. Many brand the minister's move as the root cause of all the recent tensions between Israelis and the Palestinians in the occupied territories. The latest flare-up of Israeli violence in the occupied West Bank brings to the question the regime's motive behind such escalations. One presumption is that the regime is only after taking out the total Palestinian identity from their land. In order to do that, what could be better than suppressing them by imposing an all-out blockade on millions of Palestinians and blocking their access to the outer world? To support that presumption, it is enough to say that the Israeli cabinet is planning to deport Palestinian families, at least those who the regime deems as terrorists, from their own land. That's why it pushes ahead with its policy of demolishing Palestinian homes. Many are convinced that this amounts to utter collective punishment and ethnic cleansing. There is no doubt that what the Israeli regime is doing now in the occupied land, in terms of demolition and other practices, will definitely backfire. What could be around the corner for the Israeli occupying regime is yet another intifada waiting to happen. After all, Palestinian resistance has entered a new phase and so many young people are taking part in the operations against the Israeli regime. Grassroots Palestinians with no affiliation to any of the resistance groups are rising against the regime, like the Den of Lions. The Den of Lions is an independent armed Palestinian group operating in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. The group emerged in August 22 following the killing of a Palestinian man by Israeli forces. Anti-Netanyahu rallies are being held on a weekly basis, with protesters not caring about what is happening to the Israelis in the occupied land, but rather taking aim at a prime minister who is indicted on graft charges and is willing to evade laws to do whatever he can. All in all, point to a situation where things are pulling the Israeli cabinet apart and move the regime to an ultimate annihilation.
In an article published on Responsible Statecraft, it is said that the U.S. role in Ukraine has slowly escalated since the beginning of the war there almost a year ago, saying the question now is how far Washington is willing to go. When the U.S. involves itself in a conflict, it often finds it difficult to get itself out. For instance, it happened in Vietnam. The U.S. military advisors helping the South Vietnamese fight Viet Cong forces eventually became U.S. soldiers fighting an American war. Or in Afghanistan, an initial invasion under the pretext of fighting Al-Qaeda terrorists morphed into 2 decades of war and destruction that resulted in the death of hundreds of thousands of Afghans. The same scenario could be unfolding in Ukraine. Less than a month into the Ukraine war, the US President Joe Biden stated that the US and NATO allies would not fight Russia in Ukraine. However, little by little, Washington and NATO are creeping closer to the catastrophic scenario Biden had described as World War III. Biden had also claimed the U.S. troops will not be sent to Ukraine to take part in the conflict. However, several current and former American intelligence officials told The Intercept back in October that there is a much larger presence of both CIA and U.S. special operations personnel in Ukraine than there was when the war began, saying they are conducting clandestine American operations in the country that are now far more extensive. An 8-year Army Special Operations veteran, who is now an investigative journalist, reported in December that among those covert operations is the CIA's work with an unnamed NATO allies spy agency to carry out sabotage operations within Russia. Reportedly, the cause of the unexplained explosions that have rocked Russian infrastructure throughout the war. Meanwhile, the United States and its NATO allies have serially blown past their own self-imposed lines over arms transfers. At the start of the war, analysts cautioned that the overt supply of even small arms and light weaponry risks encouraging a wider war and possible retaliation from Moscow, while U.S. officials ruled out more advanced weaponry as too escalatory. It took less than 2 months for the Biden administration to start sending these more risky tranches of high-powered arms. By the end of May, it was sending advanced rocket systems. In addition, NATO arms transfers have now escalated well beyond what governments had worried just months ago could draw the alliance into direct war with Russia, with the US and European governments now sending armored vehicles and planning to send tanks. Russia has warned the United States against its planned delivery of Abrams tanks to Ukraine. Anatoly Antonov, Russia's ambassador to the United States, has described the move as a blatant provocation against Moscow. He accused Washington of purposefully trying to inflict a strategic defeat on Russia. The warning came before the U.S. announced the delivery of dozens of its main battle tanks to Ukraine. Two American officials have been quoted as saying that the timeline of any potential delivery remains unclear and could take months or even years. Washington has said previously that providing Abrams tanks to Ukraine is not feasible, citing difficulties in training and maintenance. Meanwhile, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has decided to send Leopard 2 tanks to Ukraine and to allow other countries such as Poland to send the same tanks from their own stockpiles to Kyiv. Until now, Berlin had been hesitant to send the Leopards or to allow other nations that have them in their possession to transfer them to Kyiv, with reports early last week saying that Germany would agree to do so only if the US provided its own tanks. The decision by the US to send its Abrams seems to have provided the political cover that Berlin had been seeking. Ukrainian officials have said the tanks would be a game-changer on the battlefield. The country's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has called for a large number of tanks to repel Russian attacks.
Today, by the way, there's a lot of talk about tanks, about modern tanks that we need, and about the way this shortfall can be filled. A lot of efforts, words, promises. But it is important not to lose sight of reality. It is not about 5 or 10 or 15 tanks. The need is larger.
Zelensky said that Ukraine's allies have the required number of tanks to strengthen the country's defense against Russia. Since the beginning of the war, Ukraine's allies have sent Kyiv tens of billions of dollars worth of weapons. Western countries have also imposed a slew of economic sanctions on Moscow. Now, by escalating their support for Ukraine's military, the US and NATO have created an incentive structure for Moscow to take a drastic, aggressive step to show the seriousness of its own red lines.
IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. In the limelight.
In Britain, a charity says long-term sickness has left 1.6 million British adults over the age of 50 unable to work. According to the charity, this is not only a national health issue, but it also has economic significance. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. More than 1.6 million British adults aged 50 and over are unable to work because of long-term sickness, amid ballooning NHS waiting lists and an exodus from the British workforce since the pandemic, according to the most detailed analysis yet of official data for this age group. The number has increased 20%, or 270,000 in 3 years, according to an analysis of the Office for National Statistics, ONS, figures by Restless, a digital community and advocate for over 50s. The charity Restless says not only is this a national health issue with thousands of people suffering silently, but it's increasingly an economic issue as well, not least because many of these people would like to work in some capacity if the right job opportunities were available to them. Stuart Lewis, the chief executive of the charity Restless, made the comment. The data compared reasons for economic inactivity by age group in July to September 2019 and July to September 2022. It showed that of the 2.8 million people out of work because of long-term sickness, nearly 60% were aged over 50. In total, almost 40% of economically inactive 50 to 64-year-olds were out of work because of long-term sickness. The Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, promised a fundamental programme of reforms to get millions of people back to work in a keynote speech last week. The drive, Hunt said, would be the key to fixing the UK's productivity puzzle. A rise in long-term ill health has significantly reduced the size of Britain's potential workforce across all age groups since the pandemic. But it is a particularly large driver of the reduction in available workers in their 50s and 60s, with a number of 50 to 64-year-olds economically inactive, neither working nor job hunting, up by 375,000 since the COVID pandemic. In total, 27.6% of this age group were now inactive, an increase of 2.4 percentage points since before the COVID pandemic. This is significantly more than the 1.5 percentage point rise in the working age population as a whole. The website onenewspage.com has also covered this story and tells us more. More than 1.6 million adults aged 50 and over are unable to work because of long-term sickness, amid lengthening National Health Service waiting lists and an exodus from the British workforce since the COVID pandemic, according to the most detailed analysis yet of official data for the 50 to 64 age group. The number has increased by 20% or by 270,000 in 3 years, according to an analysis of Office for National Statistics figures by the charity group Restless, a digital community and advocate for people aged over 50. Not only is this a national health issue with thousands of people suffering silently, but it's increasingly an economic issue as well, not least because many of these people would like to work in one way or another if the right job opportunities were available to them, said Stuart Lewis, the chief executive of the charity Restless. Since the COVID pandemic, the National Health Service has struggled to keep up with demand, and waiting lists for routine operations have surged, hitting a record 7.2 million people in October in England. Those in need of hip and knee replacement surgery are having to wait up to 2 years for medical treatment. Kim Chaplin, a specialist advisor for work at the charity, the Center for Aging Better, said, "These new statistics make clear that long-term sickness is part of the challenge that the government needs to find solutions to. Among the thousands highlighted, many are currently stuck within or outside an employment support system that does not work for them," she added. John, a 64-year-old, was forced to retire last year because of severe arthritis in his hands. Unable to afford not to work, he went to Citizens Advice for guidance. He ended up volunteering for it and is now being trained as a debt advisor. Citizens Advice Bureau saw past my physical disabilities to all that I have to offer to them, he said. It didn't take much to turn me from being a burden to someone able to continue contributing to society, but I know I'm incredibly lucky. Other employers would not have taken that attitude. The Federation of Small Businesses revealed research that showed finding staff with the right skills was a major barrier to growth for 1 in 3 of small firms in England and Wales. You can't tackle this skills crisis without attracting older people and disabled people into work, said David Hale, a spokesperson for Federation of Small Businesses. That would help small businesses desperate for staff, those entering or returning to the workforce and the economy overall. B. Boilio, a research economist at the Institute for Fiscal Studies, said the findings were troubling. This rise in long-term sickness for economically inactive people is very concerning, she said. It adds to growing evidence that the British population's health is worsening.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Men and women as human beings are completely equal in Islam. This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, meeting with hundreds of prominent Iranian women in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on January 4th, 2023. If you are caught in a situation where you have to choose between saving a child's life and working in an office, the child's life comes first. Do you have any doubts about this? No. No woman has any doubt that a child's life comes first if she's in a situation where she has to choose between a child's life and working in an office. When there is a truly significant crucial obligation, it can become even more important than the life of a child. However, in normal matters, in other cases, the core responsibility of a woman revolves around her family. It is truly impossible to manage a family without a woman being present, without her endeavors, and without a woman's sense of duty. Things do not get managed. Things cannot be managed without a woman. Sometimes there are small problems in the family that cannot be resolved without the gentle touch of a woman. No matter how strong and capable a man is, he cannot solve some of these problems. These subtle problems and sometimes complicated problems can only be handled by a woman's gentle touch. So this was about the family.
دنیای اسلام The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Now, regarding the issue of the family, if we look at the issues in the West, it is a disaster. A disaster. The West has broken up families. It has truly destroyed them. Although, when I say that they have destroyed families, I do not mean that families don't exist in the West. They do. Some families are actually good families. They truly are families. The other appears to be a family, but on the inside, they are not. I was reading in a Western American text that in order to really see the children and be a so-called family, the husband and wife set a time to be together. So you come from your office and your wife comes from her office at such and such time to have a tea together in the afternoon at a set time, for example, 4 to 6 p.m. The children come from school too, and they all have a cup of tea together. That is why they call a family. One person goes off and does his own thing. The other stays up late and goes out with friends. This is not a family. It is the appearance of a family. The West has truly broken up families with the various issues that I mentioned earlier, and this has led up to gradual collapse of the families. It has even caused the Western scholars to raise their voices. They themselves, many of their well-wishers, reformists, are paying attention to this and are trying to call people's attention to it. However, I think they do not have a choice anymore. In some Western countries, the downhill slope has become so steep that it can no longer be stopped. They are going downhill. That is, the families cannot be reformed anymore. This was about the issue of the family.
I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost, you guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Islamic Revolution, Quran, Spirituality and Unity. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, these days mark the 44th anniversary of victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. We are with you with the third episode of the special series on this occasion. In this episode, We are going to discuss the status of the Noble Quran, spirituality and unity among different strata of people in the triumph of the Islamic Revolution. Please stay with us. On February 11, 1979, the news of the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran topped news agencies in the world as the Iranian nation put an end to the 2,500 years of the rule of kings in the country with throwing the Pahlavi regime in the dustbin of history. There were several factors in the triumph of the greatest revolution of the past centuries. These factors toppled the dictatorial and mercenary regime of Mohammad Reza Shah, who enjoyed the support of all big powers and enemies of humanity, particularly the US. We had said earlier that Imam Khomeini's leadership was the main factor, as he possessed every characteristic of a divine leader. His leadership resulted in the unity of the whole Iranian nation in different phases and success of the revolution. Imam Khomeini would always stress unity and solidarity of all walks of life in the country and firmly opposed any cause of discord and disunity. People unanimously hated the despotic and corrupt regime and loved Islam wholeheartedly. Their slogans and stances of Imam Khomeini were all indicative of the fact that the historical uprising of this nation had its roots in Islam. Therefore, some 1.5 months after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, more than 98% of people in an unmatched referendum voted yes to the Islamic Republic system of government. This historically unique approach to the rule of an Islamic system evidently proved that, unlike all other movements and uprisings, Iran's revolution was an Islamic and a spiritual movement. In other words, the Islamic Revolution is based on Islamic values and goals. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, said, "Until there is not the will of God, the Exalted, it is impossible for human being to reach such a unity." Although the Iranian people have deep religious beliefs, the fact that caused them to accept these beliefs as the goal and ideal of struggles against the Shah were the guidelines of their great leader, Imam Khomeini. Being aware of people's love of religion and spirituality, the Imam called on them to get united around the inspiring and anti-oppression teachings of Islam. As it has been said earlier, he took Islam out of books on the shelves of libraries and brought it to the scene of society to tackle major problems of oppressed and deprived masses. Imam Khomeini started the main phase of this struggle against the British-installed and American-supported Shah in 1963. The Imam was so brave that he said, "On the night of arresting and sending me to Tehran, I was soothing the agents of regime in the car. By God, I was not frightened. It was they who were frightened. I told them, 'Do not fear, I am here.'" Imam Khomeini liberated Islam from isolation and made people familiar with the social and political teachings of this religion. God says in verse 7 of chapter Muhammad of the Noble Quran, O you who have faith, if you help God, He will help you and make your feet steady. Imam Khomeini was the best epitome of this verse in the contemporary era, and he taught people how to fight with bare hands against a regime which enjoyed the backing of all big powers in the world. He put his trust in God, and people followed him as they found him the most honest and truthful person. Imam Khomeini directed people's sentiments toward the Ahlul Bayt of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, especially towards Imam Hussein, peace upon him, in the way of struggles against the illegal regime. He taught Muslims that they should not be silent and indifferent towards injustice imposed on their brethren. He told them that the Shah and his supporters, the US in particular, are the symbols of Yazid in the modern era. Thus, everyone should fight them to either overthrow them or sacrifice their blood in this way. When we speak of the Iranian people's following of Islamic teachings, we mean the values and laws that have been mentioned in the Quran and practiced by the Prophet and his infallible successors, blessings of God upon them. The Noble Quran, as the eternal miracle of the Prophet, was always hope-inspiring in tough junctures of the revolution. For instance, this great heavenly scripture says in verse 3 of chapter Ahzab, and put your trust in God, and God suffices as trustee. Verse 30 of chapter Fussilat also reads, indeed, those who say our Lord is Allah, and then remain steadfast, the angels descend upon them, saying, do not fear, nor be grieved, and receive the good news of the paradise which you have been promised. Imam Khomeini, as the greatest leader of modern era and the practical interpreter of the Noble Quran, would always persuade people to follow the instructions of the Quran to achieve victory. He said, we have a staged uprising so that Islam and the laws of Islam and the Quran rule in our country, and no law may not and will not be able to show itself against the law of Islam and the Quran. The main reason for enmity of the global arrogance and Zionism with the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini and whoever follows in his steps, is that they have shattered the bogus concept of separation of politics and religion. Imam Khomeini and the Iranian nation have proved to the world people that a true religion should be at the service of masses and downtrodden. Religion must be a nightmare for the US, the fake child-killer Israeli regime, and their surrogates and puppets. This is opposite to the concept of religion preached by court mullahs who justify the wrongdoings and injustices of oppressors and help them rule fearlessly.
Thank you. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The decision to send German and American tanks to Ukraine is continuing to generate controversy. Many believe the move will prolong the war, and there's concern as to how Russia might respond. However, at a parliamentary hearing on Tuesday, EU legislators were told the West should go even further.
Russia is attacking Ukraine from Russian territory, so obviously we should provide the Ukrainians with long-range missiles, obviously.
There are a lot of EU lawmakers who agree.
Any delay to supply Ukraine with needed weaponry and ammunition is more lives lost on the battlefield.
Some argue constantly supplying lethal weapons to Ukraine is foolish.
We're prepared to risk nuclear war in order to continue this US-NATO proxy war. It is total madness. And this European Union and the European Parliament have lost the plot. They've lost the run of themselves.
European Union taxpayers have provided 50 billion euro to Kiev since last March.
What happens to all the money we send to Ukraine? Is it just disappearing into individuals' pockets? Even President Zelensky has had to admit there's a big problem with widespread corruption.
A number of legislators would like to see less division within the EU.
Austria and Hungary just decided we will not deliver weapons. Okay, it's their decision. But that shows already some hesitation or some breakup of unity.
Spanish MEP Javier Nart told his colleagues it's, quote, ridiculous to suggest Ukraine can win the war against Russia. For now, the US and Germany have ruled out providing fighter jets to Ukraine. Others, including France, have not. According to many analysts, the risk that the conflict could escalate further and spiral completely out of control has never been greater. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin visited South Korea this week to reassure officials here that Washington will remain committed to the U.S.-South Korea alliance.
The U.S. commitment to the defense of Korea is ironclad. You heard us say that a number of times, but that's just not a slogan. It is what we're all about. That commitment is ironclad. And our extended deterrence is at the heart of that commitment.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol restarted large-scale joint military exercises with the U.S. last year, although the U.S. reportedly deployed its so-called strategic assets, weapons capable of delivering nuclear bombs. The South Korean leader wants more American firepower at his disposal. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has repeatedly suggested the need for the U.S. to make a stronger demonstration of extended deterrence, its nuclear umbrella. And the South Korean public has grown skeptical of the U.S. alliance, with a majority now advocating that South Korea develop its own nuclear weapons. The U.S. has also pressured South Korea for greater cooperation with Japan in participation in joint drills. Peace advocates find such a trilateral alliance worrisome.
If the South Korea-U.S. and South Korea-U.S.-Japan alliances are established through cooperative military exercises, the South Korean military will now defend Japan and the U.S. mainland in the Pacific, not South Korea. South Korea will then be reduced to an outpost to protect the United States and Japan.
Meanwhile, earlier this week, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg visited South Korea to encourage Seoul to send weapons directly to Ukraine. South Korea is exporting weapons to countries that are sending their own military supplies to Ukraine, but has so far refused to provide Kiev with direct military aid. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In a new decree by the Ministry of Higher Education, the Taliban government ordered universities and private institutions in Afghanistan not